Yeah, this is a joint work with Zuguohe at Chicago Booth.
First, let me apologize. This is meant to be a sort of a mathematical, crowd, but this paper is actually very non-mathematical, actually. But I thought the topic itself fits very well with the theme, with the sort of stability of financial markets, liquidity crisis, and so on. That's why. The first, but the model, as you will see, is not very mathematical. the motivation. So this paper, we want to analyze sort of some issue about asset market dynamics that comes from sort of something different from the standard economic theory, which emphasize a lot about agents' consumption and the portfolio choices. And also about sort of arbitrage and no arbitrage and so on, sort of what would the price fluctuate in the environment like this. But the recent credit crisis 2 years ago painted quite a different picture, right? So in that sort of period, financial institutions' leverage and debt structure actually came to the center part of sort of the financial markets, right? So which sort of was largely ignored by the standard sort of asset market equilibrium models, no arbitrage models and so on. So during this period, we know our financial institutions used a lot of leverage. So which were, I mean, of course, in the standard model, they were always borrowing by some investor there, right? But always assume they can borrow at risk-free rate and, they can sort of costless rewind their trade if it doesn't work out that way and so on, right? But this time, actually, we see when they use large leverage, when things went wrong, actually, consequence actually is not quite sort of the same sort of as what we thought about in the standard models. And also, in particular, there's a very sort of striking pattern. So the debt used by these institutions actually became very short term. So in fact, there's a figure sort of we quickly compiled together. So this is about two lines here. So the about the maturity structure of about repos and asset-backed commercial paper. These are the sort of the two most important funding channels used by institutions to finance their investment in the mortgage-backed securities, right? So the red line here is the fraction of overnight repo, overnight asset-backed commercial paper relative to termed asset-backed commercial paper. Overnight means with maturity from 1 to 4 days. We know so the commercial paper typically have maturity from one day to 9 months, right? So the red line gives the fraction of the very short end, 1 to 4 days, relative to the whole universe of asset-backed commercial paper. You can see that this fraction went from like roughly 40% in 2004 to almost doubled in 2007. Okay, so this sort of this is before crisis ever happened, right? So this is actually a good time when things are booming, market is doing well. So during this period, you can see so the more and more sort of this very short maturity debt was used actually by institutions to finance their trade. And the blue line here is about the fraction of overnight repos. Repos is sort of the security institutions use their asset as collateral to borrow from other institutions, right? So this is a fraction of overnight repo, maturity with 1 day to term repo, or with all repos, which include overnight repo and term repos. So this fraction went up from like a little bit below 15% to as much as actually went above 30% again in 2007. So we know sort of the crisis roughly started somewhere in summer 2007 and stretching into 2008, right? During sort of the crisis period, more and more short-term debt actually was used, right? Because at that time, so the only way the institution can refinance themselves is to use short-term debt, because creditors at that time are so scared that the only thing they're willing to give so the, has to be short-term. But the interesting thing and the actually most striking thing is that this even before any sort of sign of crisis, so the debt already have become very short-term. So there's an increasing use of short-term debt before any crisis. So this actually sort of suggests sort of there's actually something, systematic actually already was going on before the crisis, right? Something was going on in the market. For some reason, sort of, institutions decided they need to sort of fund themselves using a lot of short-term debt. And of course, we know later, so why did the crisis happen? So I think there's an increasing consensus among many people that the crisis eventually was triggered by, you know, the failure of this institution to refinance themselves, right? So at some point, they simply cannot, you know, refinance, because they have to sort of roll so much short-term debt. You know, right before Lehman failed, you know, 25% of its position was financed by overnight repos, right? So that means every night, Lehman had to refinance 25% of its positions. That was a striking number. So of course, that number didn't come from nowhere, right? It already started to accumulate before the crisis. So so here, so this sort of suggests that, you know, there's something systematic actually going on between sort of how financial institutions finance themselves and also sort of the asset market dynamics, right? So it appears to me sort of, you know, during the boom, actually, at least during this episode, you know, the boom was financed largely by short-term debt, actually a lot of short-term debt. And later, actually, when things went wrong, you know, all these sort of trouble, you know, started to erupt because institutions simply cannot roll their short-term debt anymore. So here, we want to sort of, you know, study sort of how sort of market participant financial financing choices interact with the asset market. Okay, so this sort of the a simple goal, you know, in the prior literature, sort of, just shortly after crisis, so the people immediately realize leverage is the problem, right? So there's now actually a lot of, you know, work about so leverage. People realize leverage is sort of a source of trouble. But I think sort of debt maturity actually is equally sort of important factor here. If it's not because of so much short-term debt, you know, if the debt actually, you know, had a longer maturity, that means refinancing can be stretched out over longer sort of a period, so the crisis won't be so bad, right? So so now, what we're going to do in this model, do here is we were trying to develop a dynamic model to analyze the interactions between investors' financing choices and asset price dynamics, okay? In the end, sort of we want to derive sort of a, you know, an outcome like a joint booms in both credit and asset markets, so that which sort of is roughly what we observed sort of during the last 5 or 7 years, you know, in the mortgage-backed security market. So here we will especially pay a lot of attention to debt maturity choice. You know, so here we will later you will see sort of here sort of debt maturity choice actually trade off something like a speculative incentive, a hedging incentive. You know, in the standard asset pricing models, so, you know, we learned a lot about hedging demand through trading, right? So here sort of as you will see, you know, maturity choice, debt maturity choice actually works quite much like sort of a similar thing, okay? You can see sort of you know, speculation and hedging demand actually along a different dimension. Here it's not about the size and the direction of your, you know, position, but rather sort of through sort of how you finance yourself. You see sort of a similar kind of thing, but coming from a different sort of a channel, okay? So I'm also going to build on sort of two lines of research. One is this sort of framework with heterogeneous belief and short sale constraint, which the literature had used to analyze asset bubbles, right? We know with short sale constraint, so the price determination mechanism is a little different, right? Because pessimists had to sit on the sideline, so the price is going to be purely determined by so the optimist, so which by nature is biased in a way upward, right? So this framework had been widely used to study asset overvaluation, as well as sort of bubble dynamics. So which is sort of natural for us to think about to expand this sort of crisis and the bubble before this crisis as well, right? But this literature tend to ignore financing of optimists, right? When optimists sort of want to buy something, so they need money, right? So where does the money come from? So initially, so in our literature, you assume so they always have the money. But in reality, we know often they don't. They have to finance themselves using debt. So here is we're going to integrate this framework with the more recent development by Gina Koplis and many others, that, you know, optimists have to finance themselves using asset as collateral. So use collateralized the debt, okay, to finance their positions. So here, sort of, we naturally integrate sort of asset market dynamics with credit market dynamics. Okay. At the end of the day, I hope that I can show you a few insights. So I mentioned already sort of the maturity choice. Okay. Here, short-term debt permits a larger leverage at a lower rate. If you choose it right, you could even borrow at sort of a risk-free rate. Okay. So, but by nature, short-term, that means temporarily, short-term debt can be risk-free, right? But eventually, you have to roll, right? When things going well, you can always roll into riskless debt as well. But when things going bad, so then you actually, the debt will eventually become risky, right? And in fact, so you will face roll risk, right? Because when things go bad, you have to go back to the creditor, and the problem is more to get it over, right? So the greater promise you make when things go bad, going to be undervalued by the creditor. So this is exactly roll risk. And in a worse situation, you actually have to sort of turn over your asset, right? Because you simply cannot get enough refinancing to pay off the existing debt. Then you end up sort of losing your asset, again, as creditor's valuation, right, which is lower than yours. So this discount is sort of in the same spirit of this word fire sale, right? So people now talk about quite a bit. So in the model, we're going to demonstrate distinctive roles of initial and future belief dispersion. In the first literature, I mentioned earlier, so people tend to treat heterogeneous beliefs as the same, right? So when optimists are more optimistic, the price will be overvalued. So whether it's sort of a near-term belief dispersion or future belief dispersion, they play a similar role, right? But in the model, I'm going to describe later, you know, because of the borrowing, actually, the initial and the future dispersion can play a very different role. The initial belief dispersion is going to stimulate our speculative incentive. Okay, optimists naturally want to sort of take large position by using debt. But if they're using short-term debt, the future dispersion is going to be a problem. Because if things go bad, they have to go back to the creditor to get the rollover, right? But then disagreement at that time is bad, because that means sort of you will have hard time to get the rollover. It means you have to increase your promise to get the refinancing, and sometimes you may not even be able to get that. So here, our future belief dispersion gonna determine the roll risk you face in the future. Okay, so ex ante, if you anticipate this, so you have to account for the trade-off, right? So if initial belief dispersion is big, you want to take the bet and use large leverage. But knowing that you're going to face a large roll risk in the future, maybe you won't hedge yourself, so using long-term debt. So in this sense, the debt maturity choice is going to trade off these two sort of forces here. So the speculative incentive as well as, future roll risk. Okay? So at the end of the day, you will see sort of we could still get a short-term credit boom, meaning optimists use a lot of short-term debt to finance themselves. But such a short-term credit boom only occurs under a set of conditions. In particular, sort of it requires a very large initial belief dispersion, but on the other hand, also require expected belief convergence in the future. Right? So only when sort of this set of conditions satisfied, you will see a short-term credit boom. So in that sense, so short-term credit boom reflects a very sort of a strong sense of excess heterogeneous beliefs. Okay? And when it occurs, it can initially fuel as a bubble, right? But later, sort of also exacerbate the downturn because it forces a lot of optimists to liquidate their position at the discounted value. Okay? So in that sense, it also exacerbates the downturn later. So in a sense, sort of we can see sort of overlaps of two cycles, right? First, so you have sort of the credit boom and the bust, then accompanied by the asset market boom and the bust. And also, the model will help us sort of sharpen our understanding about the role of heterogeneous beliefs, right? So there's a lot of prior literature on this. Trees sort of, have a very clear result, the more heterogeneous belief, higher price, and so on. But once we take into account the financing cost, the result actually could become ambiguous. Okay, So as I mentioned, sort of the key thing here is that despite the short sale constraints, pessimists can still affect the price, okay? Not directly through trading, but indirectly through our financing costs, right? Because when optimists have to get financing from pessimists, naturally, so the financing cost is going to depend on pessimists' view, right? So in that sense, you know, they still affect the price, okay? And here, you know, again, sort of the initial belief dispersion and the future belief dispersion can have very different effect on price. You know, initial belief dispersion gonna drive a higher speculative incentive of optimists, and optimists can use short-term debt to finance themselves. As a result of that, partially mitigates the financing cost effect, and as a result, higher initial belief dispersion can still lead to higher price. But on the other hand, for higher future belief dispersion, generally we get actually lower price because higher future dispersion make just simply financing costs higher. So as a result, sort of that reduces equilibrium prices. So this result kind of prompts more attention actually look at the structure of belief dispersion at different time horizons. Okay, so this will be the two sort of dimension I'm gonna focus on later. I should be very brief about literature. You know, our model gonna differ from sort of a large number of models out there analyzing credit contraction during crisis, right? We know sort of when crisis disrupt the creditor, you know, willing to provide credit, they will ask you more margins and so on, which will exacerbate downturn, right? So our nature actually is quite different. We put a lot of emphasis on the credit boom before the crisis, which is sort of the crucial for actually analyzing the trouble later, right? In fact, this is our initial motivation. So given that if you anticipate the sort of, you know, low risk later, why you still want to use the short-term debt, right? So this sort of is our key difference. And also, you know, there's large corporate finance literature there analyzed sort of the pervasive use of short-term debt in by industrial firms, right? So the standard argument will be sort of agency problem inside the firms, or, you know, short-term debt being sort of less information sensitive and so on, right? So here we explore a different sort of dimension, sort of about sort of speculative incentive of financial institutions, okay? So let me quickly get into the model. So the model, as I acknowledge at the beginning, is very simple, okay? It has two periods, 3 days. 0, 1, 2, okay, 2 periods and 3 days. You know, there's a one risky asset whose fundamental basically is the liquidation value of this asset at the end, day two. Okay, so the fundamental value follows a binomial tree. This is a standard binomial tree. I'm sure all of you are familiar with. So the fundamental each period can either go up or down each period. Okay, so at the end, it could take three possible values. One theta and theta square. So we already normalized the highest payoff to be one. Okay. So there's no intermediate payoff, just a last a final payoff. And so the tree, the movement of the tree is publicly available. So in the middle period, you everybody observed the tree went up or went down. Okay. At the end, so you get the final payoff. So we analyzed two groups of agents holding heterogeneous beliefs. Okay. So we call the one group optimist, the other group pessimist. Okay, so this is a relative sense. Okay, so one has hold higher belief than the other. So belief means the probability each group assigns to the movement of the tree during each period. So the group I, let's call I could be H means optimist, or L means pessimist. So each group assigns a probability, say each period. So the pi zero I is the group's assignment about probability going up. So in the second period, depending on the state is U or D, there's again a set of probability pi IU and the pi ID about the probability next period going up. Okay. So here, sort of we assign state contingent probability because, you know, where does the heterogeneous beliefs come from? Naturally, they come from some sort of a learning process, right? The two groups start with some initial heterogeneous prior, so they update their belief after the first period shock. So because of the difference in prior, their continuation belief is still going to be different. Okay, so here, in the paper, we're going to indulgence all this using some learning. So for the sake of now, let's just simply lay down the state contingent belief here. So for the moment, let's assume the age group always holds a higher belief than the other group throughout. Okay, later on, we actually consider maybe they will flip and so on later. Okay, so for the moment, this is easier. All right. So given that, okay, so let me lay down the setting. Okay, so let's normalize the total supply of the risky asset to be 1, okay? And let's say a fraction, mu of them belongs to the optimist. Okay, this is initial asset endowment. Okay, but naturally because they're optimistic, they actually want to own the whole thing, right? And here we assume everybody's risk mutual, okay? So naturally, sort of, given the higher expectation of the optimists, they want to buy out the rest, the 1 minus mu from the pessimists, right? The question is that, you know, if financing is not an issue, so you just go out buy, right? So what would be the asset price? Asset price would be the optimist valuation here, right? So by here, let's imagine optimists, each optimist is endowed with, say, 1 unit asset, but only $C of cash. Okay, C is a finite number. That means at least in some state, sort of, they may be constrained by their cash endowment, and they may not be able to buy out the rest of the asset from passengers using their own money, right? So then they have to borrow, okay? So now the question is how to structure the borrowing and at what cost, okay? So here, because of short sale constraints, the pessimists naturally sit on the sideline, okay? That means they also have money actually to finance the optimists to buy out the asset, right? So this sort of, you know, this actual setup is actually quite simplistic in some sense, right? Because there are actually supposed to be many people out there. So we use this setting so we can get some sort of clear result, okay? So here, let's assume sort of pessimists always have enough capital to finance the optimists as long as they're willing to, okay? So we are focused on the credit constraint on the optimist side, okay? All right. And here for simplicity, let's assume interest rate is 0. We always normalize risk-free interest rate to be 0, okay? Everybody's risk neutral, short sales are not allowed, okay? So now let's get to the central sort of issue here. Optimists need to finance themselves, okay? Naturally, they will use asset holding as collateral to obtain debt financing, right? This is sort of how it actually works in reality, right? So these are the repo contracts, asset-backed commercial paper, sort of the same. They're all the same idea, right? If you have an asset, you can also sort of send it out as collateral. So lender will give you credit based on sort of the value or their assessment of the asset value to give you credit, okay? So here, we're going to concentrate on standard non-contingent debt contracts, okay? So a non-contingent debt contract will specify a constant debt payment at the maturity, right? Unless the borrower defaults, right? So of course, all the follower will default if sort of, you know, asset value at that time is not sufficient, right, to pay off the debt, okay? So here, we are not going to sort of indulge in why debt. Okay, why debt contract? This actually is a very fundamental question. Okay, so there's some sort of classic literature out there, you know, argue sort of debt is optimal under, you know, various sort of assumptions, such as the costly state verification and so on. So in fact, in my own mind, I think debt is useful because it provides a natural sort of a ways to discipline sort of excessive risk taking by optimists, right? You know, by nature, optimism will always motivate optimists to take a lot of risk, right? But from lender side, you know, how do I control them? So debt contract is optimal in some sense because if asset value deteriorates, a control shift to the creditor, so creditor can force liquidation. So, but this, we are not going to sort of indulgence this debt contract. That's actually a totally different challenge. Okay, actually still a challenge there. So, but here we are going to actually take this kind of contract given, focus on sort of leverage choice, and maturity choice. Okay, so this will allow us sort of to focus on the, you know, joint dynamics of asset and credit market. So we can verify actually in the equilibrium, optimists will always choose face value of that between theta and the theta square and the theta, meaning sort of somewhere between this and this. Because if it's too high, it will be too costly. If it's too low, so you can finance yourself more, given the difference in belief between the two groups. Okay. And also, we can verify that in equilibrium, optimists do not save cash. This is because you can save cash in a sense, sort of, you know, when things go wrong later, you might pick up some fire sale, right? But here, you know, trade-off is that you will lose the initial sort of a position, right? You know, if you don't save cash, you can take a larger position initially. Given sort of the disagreement between optimists and pessimists, sort of initially, you are picking up a good trade, right, in your mind. So there's a trade-off. In fact, in this equilibrium, we can verify that, you know, the initial speculative incentive is always big, so that no one actually saves cash. Okay, that means it's never desirable for any optimist to, you know, sell part of their his asset later in the interim period. Okay, so this is not consideration because no one has cash from your group to buy your sale. So you don't want to sell to the other group unless you're forced to, right? So this is the out. Okay, so that means if he uses short-term debt initially to finance himself, he has to get refinanced from his creditor. Otherwise, he has to lose the asset to the creditor. And we know the creditor has a more pessimistic belief, right? That means he will only offer sort of a lower price than what the optimist values himself. Okay. So given this, so we will sort of ex ante, when the optimist finances his position initially, he has to pay attention to the possibility he might not be able to get the refinance, right? Okay. Let me start with sort of long-term debt financing. So this is actually most people in this literature sort of focus on. Okay. A long-term debt contract collateralized by one unit of asset will mature at day two, right, at the end. Okay. So let's suppose sort of it has a face value between theta square and the theta. Okay. So that means when day two comes, depending on the final liquidation value of the asset, right? So the borrower may or may not be able to pay off the debt, right? So if the realization final liquidation, you know, the face value is somewhere between theta square and theta. So if the final asset value is above theta, so you will be able to pay off the debt. Or if it's one, you will also be able to pay off the debt. But if it's theta square, you basically default, right? So that means, and also notice, if you promise more here, the face value, so you can get more credit ex ante, right? Which allows you to take a greater position, right? Okay? So the only sort of a riskless debt here is that if you only set the face value, it could be exactly theta square, right? So the debt will be risk-free. And here, given that this debt is risk-free, that means there's no undervaluation, right? Right, because you know it's gonna pay you so whatever promise throughout, right? So the creditor will exactly provide the creditor theta square, right? So in this sense, the risk-free debt is cheap. Okay, if you promise more, so there's a possibility of default, right? That means the creditor has to charge you because the creditor naturally assign a higher probability to this realization than yourself, right? So in that sense, if you use a risky long-term debt, it's going to be undervalued by the creditor. That means the creditor is expensive, right? So in that sense, you naturally trade off here, right? You know, given my initial speculative incentive, I want to take a greater position, so I want to borrow more. But borrow more, so the debt is expensive because the creditor doesn't share my view, right? So if you want to sort of cheap financing, you go to theta square contract, which is cheap, but the leverage is limited. Okay, so this sort of a trade-off. If you want more leverage, but you find the risky long-term debt too expensive, what you do, you could think about short-term debt, right? Okay, now let's think about short-term debt. Short-term debt matures in the interim date one. Okay, let's suppose the face value is, again, between theta square and the theta. Now, when date one comes, you have to refinance yourself, right? You have to go back to the creditor, you know, so make a new promise and get a new loan, right? So here, Of course, if things go well, means that the tree climbs up to state U. Well, refinancing is easy, right? Because actually asset value appreciates. So you're in a better situation, right? So you can easily get another sort of debt with the same face value. So it will be fine, right? But of course, if state goes down, say to D, now there's some problem, right? Because now credit are going to sort of reevaluate the credit risk going forward, right? So you have to come up with a new face value. Say, let's call this FS1, so that the creditor's evaluation of the new debt actually equals to the initial debt you own, right? FS. Okay? So this naturally leads to actually a consideration. So in the D state, what's the maximum sort of debt you can get? Or in other words, the asset's debt capacity. Okay? You know, if I'm holding the asset in state D here, what's the maximum amount I can borrow? The maximum amount that I can borrow is that, let me promise you theta later. That means I turn all the possible asset payoff in the future to you. How much you willing to give me? So you will evaluate that based on your assessment about probability going forward, right? So let's call this KD. KD basically will be this number. Basically, it's the creditor's evaluation of the asset value of the future payoff of the asset going forward at the end, okay? Based on their assessment of probability, okay? Naturally, this is the number between a theta square and the theta, right? Okay. So now it depends on what's the borrower's initial debt payment. If it's lower than KD. So they can always get the refinancing, right? They just need to increase the debt promise somewhat, but they will still get the refinancing, right? But on the other hand, if the initial debt, the face value actually is above KD, that means no matter what, you cannot get the rollover, right? You simply have to turn over the asset, right? So there are these two cases here. Let's stop a little bit about the first scenario. Okay, imagine sort of, you know, initially the debt payoff, FS, so the initial debt face value, it's actually below KD. That means going forward, I can always get the refinancing. Okay, that means this debt is initially riskless, right? Because going forward, I can always get the refinancing, right? That means in the first period, the debt is risk-free. That means if I promise you FS, you will be willing to give me FS, right? So in that sense, interest rate on this initial period is zero, right? Or it's actually risk-free rate. Okay? But going forward, that's actually a different story, right? You know, in the high state, in the U state, yeah, you can get another riskless debt to refinance yourself. But in D state, you can get the refinancing, but the new debt you get is actually risky debt, right? Because you have to make a new promise, FS1, which is higher than theta square. So that means if the tree continues to decline, so you will default, right? Okay, that means for the new lag, for this part of new financing, the credit actually is expensive, right? Right? So this means there's a discount to this part of new financing. And so if you do backward induction, that means at time zero, you should recognize that even though this debt initially is risk-free, you only pay risk-free rate, but in the future bad state, you're going to end up pay higher interest rate, right? Right, actually higher than what you think you should. Okay, so this is actually the raw risk, right? Okay, in the other situation, if your initial debt face value is above KD, that means even initially this debt is risky, right? Because in the lower state, you fail to get the refinancing and end up turning your asset to the creditor, right? Again, at a discount value, right? So this is also sort of a raw risk, right? Because you turn over your asset at that discounted value, okay? So this gives sort of the trade-off. Okay, now let's come back to the decision at time zero. How do optimists make their initial financing choices? Okay, the problem actually just like any standard dynamic asset pricing model, but here the optimists not only need to choose how large a position to establish, actually more important, they need to sort of choose the right financing term, right? Okay, basically it's this debt contract. Let's call this DQTA, which incorporates both maturity and the leverage inside. Basically it's about sort of final debt payment, right? It's a payment schedule. Okay, so based on this, they can obtain some initial credit, say CD. Okay, so then each credit will combine sort of the credit they get and their initial cash endowment fee. So this is sort of their purchasing power, right? So let's imagine if they put all this purchasing power to buy asset, how much they can buy? They can buy X additional shares. Okay, then put that in, sort of multiply their initial sort of expected asset payoff as well as later expected debt payment. We can get each optimus initial value function, right? So which naturally contains two effects. First is a leverage effect. If you use aggressive debt contract, meaning higher leverage or shorter maturity, you know, you can get more initial credit. So this allows you to establish a bigger position, right? So this would be a speculative incentive, right? But on the other hand, if you use a more aggressive debt contract, that means later you have to make more debt payments, right? So there's also a cost effect, right? So the cost effect naturally sort of discourage you from taking the more aggressive, you know, debt contract. So we see sort of this trade-off. This actual trade-off drives everything in this model, okay? First, let me mention sort of the maturity choice, okay? Initially, an optimist needs to decide whether to use short-term or long-term debt, right? Okay. So to facilitate this, we do a simple thought experiment. Let's imagine I want to sort of get sort of some initial amount of credit. Okay. Let's fix sort of what the target sort of credit you want to raise. Okay. So you can use short-term debt to raise that amount of credit, or you can use long-term debt to raise the same amount of credit. You can use different, you know, face value, right, and get the same thing. So which one is more costly? Okay, we can compute the expected debt payment, the cost of debt payment from the borrower's perspective, right? Of course, subject to participation of the creditor. Creditor willing to grant this amount of credit, right? So it turns out short-term debt has lower cost if and only if under this condition. Okay, this condition is a little bit, probably takes some time for you immediately to see it. What does it mean? So the left-hand side is the ratio of the optimist's initial belief divided by pessimist's initial belief. So you can think this is sort of a measure of belief dispersion between the two groups, right? So the higher this ratio, that means the optimist is more optimistic relative to the creditor. Okay? So the right-hand side, it's about sort of belief dispersion in the future lower state, D state. So here is the optimist belief standing at that point, divided by the pessimist belief in that point. Of course, conditional, you get that state, right? So this is sort of a condition, the conditional probability reaching that state from the optimist perspective. This is the conditional probability you reach that state from pessimist perspective. So this ratio basically, roughly speaking, sort of the belief dispersion between the two groups in the lower interim state. So this sort of a measure of lower risk. Okay? So let me explain sort of the intuition here. You know, as I mentioned, short-term debt has this nature, it requires refinancing, right? That means if things go well, you can get better or at least equal term going forward, right, through refinancing. But on the other hand, you will get the worst term, so in bad state, right? Okay, so by nature, that means the borrower will end up pay less in higher state, but pay more in lower state, which actually might be preferred by optimists, because optimists naturally assign higher probability to future high state, but lower probability to lower state, right? So, in particular, initial belief dispersion sort of speculates this, stimulates this kind of a speculative incentive. Right? I want to move around debt payment in the future, so I pay less in good state, but pay more in lower states, right? Okay. So this sort of the nature. So initial belief dispersion drives that. But on the other hand, we know after bad news in the lower sort of interim state. Belief dispersion is going to lead to low risk, right? Because I have to make a greater promise going forward and the creditor undervalues that. Okay, so the right hand side, this ratio basically determines this sort of undervaluation or the standing at time zero. So expected undervaluation if that state is reached. So you can see sort of this trade off. Okay, if the left hand side is higher, that means the speculative incentive dominates the roll risk. Then from the borrower's perspective, short term debt is cheaper. Okay. And here, notice that the roll risk in this model actually is endogenous determined by future heterogeneous bleeds, right? So everything here, actually, both sides of this trade-off, the incentive, speculative incentive and the future roll risk, they're all sort of endogenous determined by the two groups heterogeneous bleeds here. So based on this trade-off, you see, in the short term, that is not sort of by default the preferred one, right? Right. Actually, sort of, there have been people sort of had, made some intuitive argument before, including the couplers, arguing, short-term debt is always optimal. So it's always sort of good for optimists to use the maximum risk-free short-term leverage, okay? Which is actually in our model, basically this KD contract, which is initially risk-free, but going forward, if things go down, you barely get the rollover by basically promising out the whole asset. Right, so this definitely sort of has a cost in it, right? Basically, it's that when you roll over in the low interim state, you get a discount, a heavy discount from the creditor, and depends on sort of your initial calculation whether this is worth it. It may not be optimal depending on the trade-off I mentioned. All right, so now let me quickly mention sort of after you fix the debt maturity, let's imagine actually it turns out short-term debt is desirable. What's the right leverage you should choose? It turns out in this model, you always choose one of the three possible levels. Theta square, this is sort of a riskless debt throughout. So KD, so this is sort of the initially riskless debt contract, but going forward, it becomes risky, right? And this is sort of the most aggressive such contract, okay? And so the theta contract, so this is sort of risky throughout. So you always choose one of the three possible depending on the price. If the initial price is low, you use the most aggressive one. In the middle, you use sort of the intermediate sort of a contract, right? Give you sort of so this is the most aggressive riskless debt for the initial period. This is the least aggressive contract because the price is expensive. You don't want to take so much risk, right? So after you choose your debt contract, what determines the price? The price in the equilibrium is determined by the market clearing in asset market, right? And how does the asset market clear depends on how much credit or what's the purchasing power of the buyers, right? So we know sort of how much credit the buyer gets is the kind of, depending on the debt contract they choose, this includes debt maturity choice as well as leverage choice, right? So this amount of credit they can obtain. And this, the other side is, to buy out all these assets, one minus mu a unit from the pessimist at the price a P. So this is how much money they need to come up, right? So they have some initial cash endowment. So then this difference is the cash shortfall they have to raise from credit market. Okay, this is how much they raise by choosing the right contract. So this side actually represents the credit market equilibrium, right? And then put them together, this space is the asset market equilibrium. Okay, so then the both market clear. And depending on the level of initial endowment, we actually could have five possible scenarios. So basically this line cuts that line, so both asset market and credit market clear. All right, let me skip, I have only a few minutes. Let me sort of discuss sort of some illustration about, how does the equilibrium look. Let me go back to the initial sort of, standard, this Miller result, argue in the absence of short sale, in the absence of short sales, heterogeneous belief can cause asset overvaluation, right? Because the market is driven by optimists who by nature is upward biased, okay? So this sort of a standard result have been used to generate a lot of empirical analysis and so on. But now, So in the model I just presented to you, you know, we incorporated optimal financing costs, right? So what's going to happen once we take into financing costs? Let me show you some illustration. We're going to put in some parameters in the model, despite it's very simple, but still it delivers some actual useful, you know, illustration later. So we're going to concentrate on, you know, two type of belief dispersion. Initial one, so let's value sort of let the optimist assessment initial belief to be 0.5 plus some delta 0, or the other group is 0.5 minus delta 0. If we value delta 0, so we vary the initial belief dispersion. We can also do the same exercise if we change the two groups' belief dispersion in the lower interim state D. Okay, let's one group be 0.5 plus delta D, the other group be 0.5 minus delta D. So let's see what happens in equilibrium. So this is what happens. So this figure here illustrates the time zero equilibrium price with respect to initial belief dispersion, okay, delta zero. Okay, so the horizontal line here is delta zero. Okay, so there's a very thin black dotted line here, horizontal line, that's sort of objective valuation. Let's say that the trip operator is always half and half. We can evaluate, so what's the x and d, so the expected future payoff, right? Which has nothing to do with the belief dispersion. So it's this very black dotted line, slightly above this blue line, okay? And so the green line here is the standard Miller sort of price. If financing is not an issue, price is going to be determined by the optimist valuation, right? So here you can see when belief dispersion increases, you know, optimists become more optimistic, price goes up, right? So this is this upward sloping line here. So the blue line here, the horizontal blue line here, is the case. Let's do this thought experiment. If there's no short-term debt, and optimists have to finance themselves with long-term debt, okay, how much credit they will get? It turns out in this case, they always choose to use the riskless long-term debt. Okay, they're not very aggressive, and as a result of that, they don't get much credit. That means with the financing power they have, you know, so that's how much they can pay. And that end up being the equilibrium price, the blue line here, actually even below the objective valuation. Okay? And then, so this illustrates you how sort of how severe actual financing costs could be, right? So financing costs could be so big that these guys are not willing to borrow that much, they end up actual price is low, actually. Okay? So the red line here is that let's introduce the short-term debt. Allow these guys to use short-term debt. What would happen? So you can see, so initially for this, from 0 to 0.05, this range, actually they still don't want to use short-term debt, even though it's there. The reason is that, you know, this raw risk going forward, they're not willing, their speculative incentive is not big enough, so they're not actually willing to use short-term debt. So you can see this is still sort of like before, they're still using on. But when the initial belief dispersion becomes sufficiently large at this point, now they start to use actually short-term debt, and in particular this KD contract, this sort of maximum risk-free short-term debt for the first period. So as belief diverge further, they use more and more this KD contract, and as a result, they get more and more financing power, right? So now they can afford to bid up the price to a higher and higher level. Okay, so this is what you happen. So here you can see sort of you do get sort of, you know, price increases with the initial belief dispersion. The reason is that optimists are able to use short-term debt to mitigate the financing cost effect and bid up the price. And initially at some point they max out the financing power from that, and the price started to flat out again. Okay. And I want to quickly point out sort of this interesting thing about, you know, going forward, okay, this is how sort of the, based on what optimists finance themselves, going forward, what happens to the price dynamic. In particular, we're interested if in the interim date, you know, fundamentals deteriorate, drop to the state D, what happens? What about the price drop? So this is the middle case, price will drop, right? You know, because, you know, this bad shock, you know, optimists are disappointed, the price came down somewhat, okay? So in the sort of in the case where optimal finance with short-term debt, this is what you get. Okay, so actually this curve is steeper than the middle case. Why is this? This actually represents the shift. You know, initially the creditors finance the borrowers finance themselves with short-term debt, right? When bad shock hits, they are forced to actually turn the asset back to the creditor, who actually value asset less, right? So there's a sort of additional slope coming from the sort of the shifting asset clientele. Okay, so i.e. low risk here. So you can see, so reflecting in a steeper slope in this region. All right. So let me quickly mention the other thing. How about future belief dispersion in the interim state D? Okay. If we increase the future belief dispersion, you know, in the middle setting, effect is same, right? So higher belief dispersion in the future also leads to higher valuation anyway. So this is the blue line here. This is the blue line there. Where's the mouse? I lost the mouse. Okay, it's here. Okay, so this is the Miller case. So price still increase with future belief dispersion. But once we take into account the financing cost, actually, whether the option finance them with short-term debt or long-term debt is the same effect. The price goes down when future belief dispersion state D increases, because they're all because of financing cost effect. You know, financing cost goes up when pessimists worry more about the future defaultable states, right? So as a result of that, you know, no matter what, the price goes down. So this is pretty uniform. Okay, so I don't have time to present you the extended model with learning. So with learning, we can endogenize sort of the state contingent belief I already used in the basic model. But also with learning, we have some more interesting effect going on. With learning, you know, agent's belief can actually flip, right? That means going forward, some point actually, other agents believe actually can rise above optimist belief. That means optimists can sell their asset at a higher value, a value higher than their themselves valuation, right? So this represents sort of a resale option, which had been used by Harrison Krebs and many other, including myself, to analyze the asset bubbles before. Okay, so this side of effect will come in. Basically, it stimulates even greater speculative incentive ex ante, right? So we can get that sort of. But again, sort of, you know, once we have learning, we can also have sort of more divergent beliefs in future negative state. Okay, that sort of is a greater role risk and so on, right? So we can have both sort of resale option effect interact with sort of greater role risk in one model. So there's some sort of interesting thing we can talk about. But, you know, let me skip that so you can intuitively imagine what would happen there. All right, so let me sort of quickly sum up what we have been through sort of using the simple model, you know. So the model actually is about the short-term credit boom. I mentioned at the beginning sort of this recent crisis is basically driven by short-term credit boom to a large extent, right? But actually, this is not the only one. We had also seen some earlier ones, like in the 1990s, we had the sort of debt crisis in emerging economies, Asian and some other countries. So actually, at that time, sort of the crises were also largely driven by short-term debt, because these countries, either governments or private corporations, failed to roll their short-term debt and end up in crisis. And people had made some reservation. The same kind of pattern there before the crisis, during the boom. Actually, the boom was also largely financed by increasing use of short-term debt. And also before the, you know, the same sort of short-term credit boom was also observed in the period before the great crash in 1929. You know, at that time, a lot of stock purchases were financed by broker's loan. And actually, there's also a very quite a similar pattern. You know, the maturity of the broker's loan also shortened quite a bit, you know, through the 26, 28, of this booming period. So I thought that's interesting. So basically, across all these sort of, you know, episode, you know, eventually sort of failure to roll over eventually caused the big trouble in the market as well as in the economy. You know, so our model sort of is useful actually think about the, you know, why does this whole thing happen, right? The full cycle. You know, here in our model, sort of a short-term credit boom can fuel an asset market boom and then exacerbate the downturn after some bad shock, right? So in a sense, so this demonstrates the importance of financing choices actually for understanding asset market dynamics, which, you know, has been largely ignored sort of in the standard asset pricing literature. Okay, our model provides some conditions to characterize the rise of such short-term credit boom, and also our model sort of useful for thinking about this sort of literature on asset bubbles generated by heterogeneous belief and short sale constraints. So you can see here, you know, despite the short sale constraint, you know, heterogeneous belief effect on asset prices actually can be ambiguous, depends on, you know, whether it's long term, or whether it's initial belief dispersion or future belief dispersion actually affects is actually quite subtle, right? Okay. So that's what I want to say.